fantasy baseball fans and baseball fans alike. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. Very exciting program today. I'm very excited to bring on Ron Chandler. We're going to be talking about the daily fantasy sports industry. For those of you out there who like fantasy sports, obviously you're very familiar with daily fantasy sports. But even if you're just a baseball fan and you don't play fantasy sports or you don't play daily, I don't know how you're not at least aware of the industry. A lot has been going on. And we did this kind of segment back in early March. I wrote an article for Baseball America talking about the daily fantasy sports industry. And I interviewed Ron Chandler at that time, both for background, because I wanted to get his insights on the industry. And he's an expert when it comes to these kinds of things, a legend in the fantasy sports industry. But also I wanted to do a podcast so that people could listen to what Ron had to say and get his opinions and things like that. So I kind of double whammied it, as I like to say, in fantasy football. I used him for my article, and I also used him to provide some pretty good information and a pretty good podcast. Now, that was back in late April, early March. Recently, ESPN came out with an article of their own, very long, very well-researched, more of a storytelling kind of piece, discussing how the industry got started and really through the eyes of the FanDuels and the DraftKings. There are lots of other daily fantasy sites out there, but the article focused on those two because obviously they're by far and away the industry leaders. It talked about how they got started and how the industry kind of blew up, and then by his implication, how it imploded. That's one of the headings at the top of the piece, is the implosion of the daily fantasy sports industry. And that's one of the things that caught my eye. Implosion is an interesting term. But the future of it, the one conclusion I think you can come to if you want to read my article at baseballamerica.com is that the future is murky. That was back in, again, April and March and April, early March. I think it was March 4th, I think, actually, was when my article was published. So maybe February or March is when we actually did the podcast. But the one thing I think we definitely came to a conclusion on is that the industry's future was murky and very much unknown. Now ESPN comes out with this article, and we've got fantasy football coming up, and we've had some legal decisions in New York recently. So the industry is changing, and I want to bring Ron back on to talk about that. He's author of The Baseball Forecaster. It's his 31st annual edition coming out this winter. Fantastic publication. Ron does a fantastic job. You can ask anybody. I'm not just smooching a little bit of butt here because he's coming on the program on a couple of occasions. Ron is very well known. If for anyone out there who doesn't know, he's very well known in the industry, very well, very highly respected. And his annual edition there is one of the more popular things you're going to find out there. So I highly recommend it. You can also find him over at ronchandler.com, ESPN.com. He's associated with ESPN, who came out with the article. And, of course, if you want to follow him on Twitter, which you definitely should be, it's at Ron Chandler. Let me bring Ron into the program right now here. Ron, thanks a lot for coming on again. I know you're a busy guy, but daily fantasy sports is definitely an interesting topic, and we're very happy to get your opinions on it.
Well, thanks, Chris, for having me on again. It is definitely a hot-button issue, and I'm glad to talk about it.
There's so many things to get to. It's such a wide array of topics, and we're not going to get too much into the legals because we're not lawyers. We don't even fake like we are on TV here or on radio, so we're not going to get too much into that. Maybe I'll have Rick Wolf on from the FFTA. He's very knowledgeable when it comes to that. I believe he's actually a lawyer and participates in some of the proceedings in a variety of different states, so maybe I'll have him on. I'm going to contact him about possibly bringing him on when it comes to that, because it gets pretty intricate, and we don't even really know the legalities of these kinds of things. But there's so much to get to here. It's almost difficult to start. I guess going all the way back when we spoke in late February, early March, the industry was very much in flux. DraftKings and FanDuel were fighting the state. They eventually settled with them. I guess let me start off at the very beginning and just ask. The ESPN article suggests, and a lot of people seem to believe that this might be the case, and maybe this is just because it became so high profile, is the advertising onslaught that we got from both of those sites. You know, football season came along, and it's my thought that this industry essentially lives and dies by fantasy football, and daily fantasy sports is probably a significant portion of that as well. Do you believe that all of this happened because they just went crazy and bought all this advertising, and they just exploded onto the scene? That seems to be where they're laying it at the doorstep. It's like the suggestion, I think, by the article, and you can correct me if you disagree, is that it imploded because of hubris, because of a little bit of ignorance, and because of this just onslaught of advertising that just was so in your face that it couldn't be ignored.
Well, sure. I mean, that didn't help the situation any. The companies were spending hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising. You couldn't go 90 seconds on a TV program without seeing a commercial for FanDuel or DraftKings. So that certainly raised some eyebrows. I think, though, that it might have evolved slightly differently had not the allegation came out of insider trading, which turned out to be false, but it was sort of a trigger moment. Where everybody said, wait a second, is this even a legal enterprise? Are people scamming the public here? And I think that was sort of like a watershed moment for things kind of falling apart. But certainly the advertising raised the eyebrows, and then things just kind of fell apart from there.
And the article kind of gets into that. We'll get into that a little bit later, but it talks about how they rely on the whales and how they're kind of taking advantage of the smaller casual player and things like that. The ESPN article gets into that, and that is an interesting part of it. Jumping forward just a little, because I'm going to try to be as organized as possible here, but there's a lot to try to get into. Let me ask you about the settlement that the companies entered into. What was I remember when that settlement happened a few months ago to suspend play in New York, because they were fighting them legally. And again, we're not going to get into the legal specifics or make legal predictions. But the companies were fighting New York, that they were arguing they should be allowed to play while these legal proceedings were happening. And then eventually there was a settlement. And a lot of people in the fantasy industry, and they have a self-interest involved, so you always got to wonder about that. But their argument was that was a good thing for daily fantasy sports. I'm curious what you thought about that settlement, and then I'll ask you what's the implication now and where they stand now. But what was your thoughts when that settlement happened, and what did you think it meant?
Okay, well, but from the company's standpoint, that was clearly a good thing that happened because the players in New York represented, I think, the first or second most populous state where they had people playing their games. So to be able to offer their games in New York was huge for them. It allowed them to basically kind of set a benchmark for what type of legislation might work. But let's take a step back and look at this from a different perspective. We have two companies here who basically got too greedy too quick and put the entire industry under the legal microscope. But really, it was all about damage control and survival from that point. The New York decision was important, but the whole effort was really trying to figure out a way to scale back their misdeeds while still preserving their companies, which is really a tough balancing act. But because there was already too much money invested in you know, FanDuel and DraftKings and too many big media companies and sports leagues were involved, it was a big incentive not to let them fail. So they had to find a way to do that. But the question now is, what are we left with once the dust clears? And we're really still a good distance away from the dust really clearing. And New York is just one point in time, and we still got all many, many states who this is still up in the air about. So what we're likely to be left with is a DFS game that's going to have to be watered down version of what the public really wants, just from an accounting standpoint. Yet there's still not a level enough playing field to allow for an open marketplace. And that, for me, that is like the key thing here, that New York just didn't go far enough. It might seem like a worthy compromise, the New York decision, and it's already, like you said, it's being spun as a win for the industry. But until we really have a truly open marketplace for all DFS companies, not just those who can afford to do business in a particular state, and until we have a game in which skill and not bankroll truly determines who wins and who loses, then we're nowhere near a level playing field. So I think we still have a ways to go. And like you said, it's going to remain murky for a while.
And for those who don't really know about the decision or aren't aware of it, can you give some details about what that was? I mean, again, not getting into the legals, but can you give some details
sure.
so people have an understanding of what that agreement was?
Sure. The New York decision basically establishes a minimum age of 18 to play. You can't DFS contests can't include any collegiate sports or horse races or anything like that. A key thing is that DFS is exempted from the part of the New York code that deals with gambling. So basically it says it's not gambling, which was a very important part. There were a bunch of consumer protections that are put in place. But from a monetary standpoint, this is the interesting part for me, that anybody who does business in New York State must pay a tax on their gross revenue of 15%, as well as another 0.5% tax with a cap of $50,000. So basically, not all the DFS companies are going to be able to afford to do business in New York State, because this is, if you're going to tax them 15% on their gross revenue, you can't be paying out 90% of your intake in prizes. The accounting just doesn't work. So something is going to have to give there.
Yeah, and actually that was something I was going to get to at the end, but since you kind of put it right here up in the at the front, that was my question. Is essentially, for those of you out there who don't know how these companies work, is they try to jack up these gigantic jackpots to create huge amounts of players, and not even a huge amount of players, but even exponentially more entries, and then they take a small sliver, and gamblers would call it a rake. Fantasy people aren't supposed to talk about gambling, and this is actually a podcast. This is a baseball podcast, but I work in the fantasy industry, as obviously you do too. We're not supposed to address gambling in any way, shape, or form. That's kind of the mantra of the industry at the moment. But they take a small percentage of each entry, and then they, and like you said, then they give out 90%. I'm curious how they go about doing that. Since you mentioned that the financials don't work, I'm curious, have you heard how, or do you have any thoughts on how financially they will work if they have to give 15% to taxes and they're only taking, like you said, 10% of the entry fees?
Yeah, it's unless there's some creative accounting we don't know about, that something has to give. I really don't know how they're going to do it. The big prizes are going to have to come down. They're probably not going to be able to offer the big million-dollar prizes as large or as often as they've done in the past. But I haven't heard any specifics as to how that's going to change. And, you know, with the football season coming up now, I'm sure we're going to start seeing some of the fallout from this.
Yeah, and just for my personal opinion, I play over at FantasyDraft.com. I have not played on FanDuel or DraftKings, but there are other sites. You see CBS or Yahoo, they all have their own things. You know, I log into my Yahoo leagues, and you can enter into a DFS event. And I'm not a big gambler. I don't play DFS for the gambling, but the money is an element of it. Again, I don't gamble on other sports. I'm not a gambler. I don't go to the track. I don't get this gigantic rush from gambling. But if you remove the money from DFS, it definitely minimizes the interest. And the one from my personal experience is that I think it's Yahoo, but it could be CBS. And they offer these events, and it's like a dollar. But the winner of that event wins like $6. Now, like I said, gambling and the rush of gambling isn't really a huge draw for me, but entering a dollar in order to possibly win six, that doesn't make me want to play it. that's troublesome.
No, you're absolutely right. And the money part of this is a huge aspect of this. And part of the ESPN article that got me really angry is at one point, Jason Robbins, who's the head of DraftKings, he makes a statement. He says that they've done research, and the money aspect is like reason four or five why people play. The main reason they play is for the competition or playing with their friends and stuff like that, which to me was just an absolute insult to my intelligence and an insult to the intelligence of everyone who plays these games. Because if these companies are really trying to be transparent and open and make consumers well-informed, they can't be shoveling this garbage on us. There is no question that the money is a huge part of this game. If there were no cash prizes, there would be no DFS. Dave Potts would not be spending 6 hours a day creating hundreds of lineups if there was not a cash incentive. It's not a sustainable business model without the cash prizes. There's no other way to spin it. And for them to try to spin it that way, it's insulting.
Yeah, it's sort of like listening to Trump. He tells you things that you absolutely know are lies, and he says it with such a straight face, and he says it in such a convincing way that that's what makes me angry about politics. And I'm a person, to be honest with you, I like DFS. If you like, I play yearly leagues. I love yearly leagues. I like dynasty leagues. If there was a DFS, and essentially you got, you know, with football coming, college pick'ems and professional pick'ems, where you just pick the winners every single week and you see how you do against other people, I actually enjoy doing that. So I would enjoy maybe, you know, in some of my Yahoo leagues are daily transaction leagues. If there was a DFS league where you could play every single day, I might play. But I absolutely am 100% on board with you, is you could not maintain a business model based on the very few people that would actually enjoy playing DFS if there was no money. There aren't a lot of us out there. I would like to, but I absolutely know millions and millions and millions of people won't. So to try to even claim it is insulting.
Right. Now, FanDuel and DraftKings have introduced basically a season-long version of their daily game where you play, well, during football season, you play once a week in a league with your friends. And I haven't really followed exactly how they're monetizing that, but they're basically trying to make it more of a competition for the ESPNs and the Yahoos in their full-season leagues, though it's still a weekly competition during the NFL season. Now, the question is, assertion is that this is what people want, and it kind of takes the focus away from the monetary aspect. My question is this really sustainable too? I mean, are these really going to survive? Are they going to be successful when the key incentive for playing these games has been since the beginning the huge cash prizes? So it'll be interesting to see if they can make a go of that.
And I'm curious, because the money that they take out of the entry fees is a relatively small amount. If they do increase that to 11, I mean, like you said, if they have to pay a 15%, you know, on profit, again, profit is an interesting term in business because you've got behind the scenes expenses. So if you have to pay 15% of a company's profit when they have all their expenses behind the scenes, that doesn't mean they'll lose 15% of every entry fee. It just means they will have a significantly larger overhead than what they currently do now. So that will definitely be a hit, but it won't be, you know, if you pay $10, if you pay $100 to enter, they're not going to lose 15 of that to tax, but they'll lose a significant portion. But do you think players – let me finish and then you can go ahead.
Sure.
I was just going to say –
No, it's just
if they jacked
15%
it up,
of the gross. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 15% of the gross. Okay. Thank you for correcting me.
Okay.
My mistake.
Yeah.
Then they would lose it. Okay. That's even more painful.
Yeah.
So they can't even hide the cost behind expenses. So that's even more – that makes it even more painful. It doesn't change my question, but thank you for correcting me there, because that's important. That is a significant difference in the financial model. But if the jackpots are large enough, and that seems to be the draw, the million-dollar maker and things like this, and all of a sudden you see Drew Dinkmeyer going flipping out because he got a touchdown in the fourth quarter and won $1 million and all that, that's what draws people to it. That may have been what drew the legal people to come to these people, because they really did kind of push the money angle when they were doing in the gambling angle when they were advertising when they first did it. I think that's one of it. The perspective that they took to advertising was probably a mistake. But as long as you have those huge pots, would people be willing to allow them to take 30% of their entry fee rather than 10?
They may not have a choice. I mean, that's what it's going to come down to. People are used to having 90% of their entry fee being paid back in terms of prizes, but the accounting doesn't work. So they're going to have to get used to a completely different model. And for some, they might not play. It's possible. I mean, I offered a monthly game for a couple of years, and unfortunately the timing of introducing it was kind of off because it's just when DFS exploded. So I shut it down after about a year and a half. But one of the biggest complaints about it was that I wasn't returning enough in prizes, and I was returning 80%. So because it was a startup, and I wasn't a huge company with huge funding, so I had expenses to pay and overhead and whatnot. And one of the biggest complaints was that I wasn't returning enough in prizes. So fair, they have to return only 70% in prizes or 75%. There's probably going to be some pushback.
Yeah, because my thought would be if the tournament is large enough and the jackpot is large enough, and that's fine. If you have to invest $100, but you win $700,000, that to me seems like people might do that. But I'm curious how that jacking it up to say 30% for the with the smaller amounts, like I said on Yahoo or CBS, if I have to invest $1 to win $6, that's not going to do it. But if I invest $50 to maybe win $10,000. Yeah, that's something I would probably do. I'm wondering if that may people probably don't care about the percentage, right? It's just the jackpot has to be big enough compared to the investment?
For the most part, but a lot of them do the math. They look to see exactly what they're getting back in terms of their entry fees. So, I mean, there's some people – I mean, once the numbers get big enough, you're going to draw people in to play the game. But those who are grinders who've been playing for a while, who are gamblers who participate in DFS, and there are tons and tons of gamblers who play DFS, they're looking at the payback. And they're saying, well, this company is only returning X number percentage back of my entry fee. I want better odds. And so they might go someplace else where they might get better odds.
And the one place that I think this is maybe is the biggest problem to the model, and this is one of the things I think the article does a very interesting job in discussing, is that they cater to the whales. These guys that play 600 or 700 lineups per tournament, they invest as much as hundreds of thousands of dollars in one event, but they walk away with they're those small percentages that win. And that you actually, the whales have to feed on kind of, I hate to put it this way, but the suckers, the people who enter once or twice or three times. And the real damning part of the story that really struck me, and I knew that this was true, I just didn't know it to the degree that he kind of pointed out in the article. Again, Don Vinata from ESPN Junior did a great article, or a very interesting article over at ESPN. Don Vinata Junior. He basically said, if you don't enter hundreds of times, you have absolutely no chance to win. That, to me, is a problem, because for a business that needs entries, that needs players, if 99% of the people enter less than 50 times and you can't win without entering, let me just randomly throw out 200 entries in an event, aren't people eventually going to wise up and they're going to just lose a huge portion of the population, and they won't be able to sustain their model that way either?
Yes, and that's why the New York law put in a couple of consumer protections in place to inform the public exactly what their odds actually were. And there was an article about a year ago that came out that said that only about 1% of the players were earning 90% of the winnings. So, yeah. Particularly in the tournaments, unless you enter many dozens, hundreds of entries, you're basically dead money. You might as well be playing the lottery, because there's no chance for you to win. And it's a matter of consumer education, and it's a matter of giving those players who still want to play and enjoy the game, I mean, we do enjoy the game, other means to play with a more of an opportunity to win. And I think single entry, 50-50 games, things like that are fine games to play. And I actually play them. I love them. They're great. But people need to know that if you're expecting to be able to go into DFS, drop a few dollars and win, you know, $100,000, let's look a little bit more better perspective here. If you want to drop, you know, 1 or 5 or 10 and win 50 or 100, that's really what you should be aiming for, because you have no chance at the big money wins.
And as I said, I don't play DraftKings or FanDuel. I knew about the fact that you really can't win the big jackpots unless you are essentially a professional. If you don't enter hundreds of times, and if you're entering hundreds of times, essentially this is your career, this is your job, and so you're a professional. I am not a professional daily fantasy sports player, and so I would never enter hundreds of times, and I don't have the money to invest in that. So I haven't been playing on those sites, but I play on FantasyDraft.com. And I like baseball. Baseball is my most fun. Football was fine, but for me, I love baseball. You can invest $5 to win a couple hundred. And one of their biggest tournaments is you invest $25 and you can win anywhere between $600 and $700 if you win it, to a couple thousand. You know, sometimes they change up the tournaments and you might have a big one where you can win $2,000. I actually won $2,300 one night in one of the tournaments. That, to me, it makes it worth it. $25 to win $700, and of course on the nights when it's $2,000. No, that to me is a fair enough of an exchange. What is DraftKings and FanDuel's offering as far as it goes? What do you have to invest, and what's the maximum you can win? How many players are in it? Because again, I'm not familiar with what they're doing now. How is their business, or what are their numbers when it comes to those as we stand right now on August 31st?
Yeah, I can't answer that. I really
okay.
I,
so you don't play those.
I too haven't. Yeah, I haven't been playing since everything happened over the winter. I actually wrote about it, and I said I will play in every other site this year. I will not be playing in FanDuel and DraftKings. I think that everything they've done is done to hurt the industry. I will not support them, and I have not played in either of their games this year. So I've been playing with RT Sports because they've been supporting the Tout Wars League and USA Today involvement with what I used to work for. So I've been playing mostly RT Sports and mostly small-dollar games. And, again, not in it for money, in it for the intellectual challenge and that sort of stuff. And from that aspect, it's been perfectly fine. It's been a lot of fun.
And how have you noticed again, we talked in late February, early March. We're talking again today. There have been changes in the industry, and we'll see if we can get into some of those here without getting too much into the weeds of it. What changes have you seen in the industry, both at the big guys, the FanDuels and the DraftKings, but also the smaller ones? Like you said, RTC, I play a fantasy draft. I write for them a little bit. I've seen some of the impact on how their businesses run based on the changes. What kind of changes have you literally witnessed, and what industry changes are you aware of when we talked back in February and what we're talking today?
Yeah, other than these new type of games that FanDuel and DraftKings are offering, you know, trying to give more of a full season spin on it, I haven't seen really that many changes overall from the past. You know, some of these smaller companies still trying to navigate through what's been going on, stay a little bit under the radar because you know, right now it's still illegal in several states. There's still some states that say no, you can't offer this in our state at all. But from the actual offerings, I haven't really seen a whole lot of changes, to be quite honest.
And what's your opinion on my comment early on when we first started talking was that in yearly leagues, fantasy football is the thing. Everyone loves fantasy football. It's SiriusXM starts talking fantasy football in July. They no longer talk baseball, which to me is absurd, but I understand it. I think it's kind of ridiculous, but I understand it. Football is so much the king that there's not enough listeners that want to listen to fantasy baseball talk in July. I mean, the trade deadline was happening, which is the most exciting part of Major League Baseball season, and yet they were no longer talking about fantasy baseball. Essentially.
Yeah.
That to me is kind of stunning.
It's depressing.
It is. And I talk about baseball every two or three days a week on these podcasts. Is that the case in daily, or are the other sports at least competitive, or are they close to as popular, or does the industry literally need to live on daily fantasy football to survive?
The industry needs both football and baseball, and to some extent basketball too. I mean, football, because just the sheer volume of people who play fantasy football, like you mentioned, I mean, anywhere for every fantasy baseball or basketball player, there are anywhere from 8 to 10 fantasy football players. So it's huge, the difference in the number of people who play. But by the same token, baseball, you've got a game every night. You're playing for 180 days during the course of 6 months. And so that's revenue that comes in every single day, not just on the weekends, not just once a week as it is in football. So they really need both to survive. And, you know, from their aspect, baseball is very important because the frequency of contests that they can offer during the course of the baseball season.
And one of the implications or suggestions they made in the Mr. Venata made in the article was that one of the ways that DraftKings became a competitive FanDuel was, and this is how all entrepreneurs and businesses work, is that you have to find your niche. So you don't have to enter the same field that everyone else is. You pick these small little niches that aren't being serviced properly. The suggestion in the article was that one of the ways that DraftKings became competitive with FanDuel was they offered sports that FanDuel wasn't offering. Is that still the case?
Well, sure. I mean, any way to differentiate yourself. I mean, the basic baseball game, their major differentiation is that the FanDuel has one pitcher in their lineup and DraftKings has two. So, I mean, little things like that offer some differentiation. But where DraftKings kind of went off the rails a little bit is they started offering DFS competitions in, like, golf tournaments and NASCAR, which kind of defied the tenets of the Unlawful Internet Gambling Act of 2006, because that act specifically said that in order for fantasy to be legal, it had to include multiple games. And a single golf tournament or a single NASCAR race is not multiple games. Yet they were offering DFS competitions on that, which clearly crossed the line. And even though they were warned by the FSTA not to do that, they continue to do that. And that's, you know, and one of those other issues that kind of eventually raised the eyebrows.
And do you know how that is going to go going forward? Because for example, I don't care about NASCAR. I make fun of NASCAR, but I do like fantasy golf. I've been playing fantasy golf for years, not for money, but I've been playing it for years. And I could see theoretically, if you really wanted to make it legal, golf is a four-day event. I guess you could say that would be, I don't know, are these going to survive, and are these going to be considered legal in not gambling, things like golf and NASCAR? Or are those going to – do you have any idea what the legal status of that? Again, I don't want – do you have any idea at all?
No, I really don't. No, I really don't, no.
Because I haven't heard anyone discuss it. I haven't heard anyone say football is going to be fine, baseball is going to be fine, but golf isn't. I haven't heard that. And Fantasy Draft had to suspend some of their golf tournaments for a couple weeks because they have to exclude certain players because they can't play in golf while others can. But it wasn't because golf is going to be made illegal. It was because they didn't have this software in place to exclude players who can't play and allow players that could. So I haven't heard anything anywhere that says that golf is not going to be allowed to be a DFS sport. I'm assuming you haven't heard that either?
I haven't either. I just know what the law says, and the law said that it does not qualify based upon the fact that it is a single event and not a multiple game event. So how the lawyers will eventually determine it, I really don't know, but that's really all I know about that.
Let me get your ethical opinion on this one, and this is not a legal question, but like we kind of discussed a few minutes ago, it seems like you need the dead money, and this is poker players know this very well. You need the dead money in order for the whales to win. I've run a few businesses in my day. I treat people fairly and ethically, but I know that a lot of other people don't. And in America these days, greed, as Gordon Gekko said, is good. People almost justify that if you're successful, especially financially, it doesn't really matter how you do it. It seems like most people say, look, you're a success. I respect you because of it, whether you do it ethically or not. And we're seeing that with Donald Trump. He's hailed as a success, but I can guarantee you, I know real estate developers. They are not ethical people. if you need dead money in order to keep a thing going, as long as you inform people, is it okay for as one of the crutches of your business that you need dead money in order to survive? That almost seems unethical, even though you say you give them the information, which they haven't up to this point. They were not transparent before. Supposedly going forward, they're going to be. As long as they're transparent and honest, is it okay for them to rely on dead money in order to be able to survive as a business? Ethically, do you think that makes a lot of sense?
Well, I think as long as there's full disclosure, how is this any different than playing the lottery? I think people recognize that when they go and they put down their quick pick, that the odds of them winning is pretty remote, yet they still do it all the time, and they know that odds are they're dead money. So I don't know if there's a whole lot of difference in that.
I think I would argue that it's kind of unethical for states to run lotteries too. A, they're not allowing businesses to run a gambling, which essentially a lottery in many ways is. And a lot of times also, while lotteries, they justify it by the state bringing significant amounts of tax dollars, which they then spend on services, but they often victimize the people who need the money the most in order to do it. I think a pretty good argument would be that states shouldn't be running lotteries because ethically, it's not good, and they are for the most part. I mean, there's been studies that kind of show rich people don't play the lottery anywhere near as much as poor people do. I think
sure.
A pretty good argument would be that it's not ethical to have lotteries. They're doing it, but I think a pretty good argument would be that states shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, but it currently now they do, and they do generate revenue. And again, it is a matter of a consumer education. And perhaps if those people who play the lottery recognize that they really don't have a chance, then maybe they wouldn't play it as often. But this is kind of the world we live in right now.
And looking at the changes that these companies need to make, at smaller entry tournaments, the fact that they're being taxed and all these things, what was your thought of the daily thing? Because you've been in it, you ran it. What were your thoughts about daily fantasy sports when you first got involved with it? When did you first get involved with daily fantasy sports? And what were your thoughts about the industry and what it could be back then?
Well, when I first started dabbling in it a couple of years ago, I didn't like it at all. I mean, I thought it was completely in opposition to all the long-term analysis that I've been doing in the baseball industry now for 30-plus years. And I thought it was basically to have to predict what's going to happen over the course of a single game. Is a crapshoot, and I still maintain that full season fantasy is a vastly different game. It's a much richer game, and it's far less prone to random variance. And the big but here is that if you readjust your perspective on DFS and recognize what it is and what your potential success rate should be, then it could be a lot of fun. I mean, you're using different indicators, different variables to try to predict the short-term performance of players. But like I said, I play 50-50 games because my success in these games is probably limited to be able to predict who's going to predict finishing in the top half of a group of competitors rather than trying to finish in the top 5 or 10 or 100 of thousands of competitors. And I can do pretty well, creating a lineup that positions me in the top half of competitors. But that's the level of success that I'm comfortable with that I think is truly predictable. I think beyond that, it becomes far too random, and I typically don't enter tournaments because of that. So that's kind of how I see it.
And one of the arguments is supposed to be, or this was the basis of the argument for a lot of the daily fan, the fantasy sports industry, was that it is a game of skill. Now, granted, you're going to have some people who don't know players, don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to evaluate whether a player's dollar value for when they budget their team is a good value or not. There are some people that just don't know those. But let's assume that there's at least a fair amount of people that are at least somewhat knowledgeable in that. How much is it a game of skill once you get into that? I don't know what percentage you would put it. Let's say 20% of the fantasy players are all in the same ballpark. If you're going to put them in leagues, and that was one of the things that I've heard is one of the possible ways that the industry should be regulated is that you essentially have a professional league and you essentially have a minor league, and you can play in different leagues and you rank people. How that would work and function, I don't know, but I can understand the philosophy behind it at least. Let's assume that you've got 20 or 30% of the people who have at least enough knowledge where they can consider themselves competitive against other players. You kind of suggested it there. How much of it is a game of skill? If you're playing it and I'm playing it against each other, are you going to beat me 9 times out of 10 because it's a game of skill, or are we going to split 50-50 because it is random? I'm curious about how if the argument for why DFS should be allowed is it's a game of skill, how much skill is it? I guess is my question to you.
Well, I mean, the way I've kind of written about it in the past is that I look at it this way, and I'm just going to use round numbers for the sake of argument here. Let's say there are 100,000 possible winning lineups, okay, on a given night. By using skill, okay, by doing the analysis and looking at matchups and every other variable that you can come up with, you can find from the 100,000 possible outcomes, you can find the 1,000 best lineups that could possibly win. And knowing that somewhere within that 1,000 is going to be the winning lineup. So skill has narrowed you down from 100,000 possibilities to 1,000 possibilities. Now, within that 1,000, my contention is it's pretty much random. It could be anywhere within that 1,000 that the winning lineup is going to come out of. Skill gets you part of the way there, but once you get to a certain point, then it becomes random. And that's why I'll play the 50-50s, because I can get down to those 1,000 possible lineups, and I know that whichever lineup of that 1,000 I pick is going to end up in the top half of the competition. But for me to pick the lineup, or even the 5 lineups that are going to end up at the very top to win that big tournament prize, that I think is more of a crapshoot.
And going back to my original question about what you thought of daily fantasy sports when you started it, what do you think of daily fantasy sports now?
It's my opinion has basically changed. I mean I look at it as a intellectual challenge. I don't play it for the money. I play very small stakes. I'm just, it's needless to say, I don't want to be losing an entire bankroll. So I usually play 10% of my bankroll on any given night. I play once or twice a week if I have the time. I mean, I know some people who have to play every night because it's all in the volume. But it has to be a recreational pursuit for me. Otherwise, I don't enjoy it. So, but as far as my involvement in the game now, I still play the 50-50s and have a good time with it.
And going back to when we first spoke in early March and what we're seeing the changes over the last few months, how drastically or how little has the industry changed since my article came out for Baseball America in early March and the ESPN article that came out last week on ESPN?
I think everyone's still jockeying for position here, trying to figure out how this is going to look once the dust clears. New York was an important milepost here, but all the state legislatures have been out for the summer, and once we get back into the fall, and things will start gearing up again. And there's still plenty of states where this stuff is still up in the air, and there were still several states, I forget, whether it was Minnesota or Missouri, one of those states, actually likened DFS to prostitution. So, I mean, we've got a long way to go before we inform these states about what fantasy sports is in general and specifically DFS. So from what I had spoke to some folks in the FSTA back in the spring, they're expecting this whole process to take a good 2 to 3 years before they're able to get their lobbying efforts into all the states and to have decisions brought down. And once it looks what it looks like, once it's all done, it remains to be seen. I mean, we still might have a patchwork of a country where you can do business in some states and not in others, and DFS is legal in some states and not in others. But it's a state issue, not a federal issue. So it could be very messy once this thing all ends.
And one thing that I remember when I was doing my article, and I spoke with some of the people over at the FSTA, and some of them are lawyers and some of them know the legal ins and outs. And while some of that kind of flew past me, I kind of grabbed on to pieces of it. But this is kind of a state by state election, as the politicians love to say. So they could literally get different terms and be operating under different financial ramifications in every single state. So while New York is the biggest for the DFS companies, my understanding, without you being a lawyer, is that they could literally be Massachusetts guidelines are going to be different than Missouri might be. And while Utah probably will never allow it, and Vegas is going to tax them out of it. But it feels like, is it your sense that even though it's going to take 2 or 3 years, that every single state is going to be so unique that you could literally have completely different things? You could almost have it be a local business where a certain DFS can function in Massachusetts, but it couldn't function in Florida based on their rules. We could theoretically see something like that, couldn't we?
Absolutely, and it's already happening. I mean, even though the law was passed in New York, New York was not the first state to pass legislation on DFS. For instance, in the state of Virginia, they determined that DFS is legal, but in order for a company to do business in the state of Virginia, they have to pay the state $50,000 up front just to do business in the state. So now, basically, FanDuel and DraftKings can afford to do business in Virginia because $50,000 for them is pocket change. But all the smaller companies can't, and so they've basically blocked all the smaller companies out of doing business in the state of Virginia. So every state is going to have different rules, and because of that, it, like I said, it's going to be a patchwork of it's going to be a legal nightmare, to be honest.
One industry, again, this might be something neither one of us are qualified to discuss, but I want to ask you about it because this, to me, is an intriguing aspect to it, is how the money is handled. Because with people depositing their money in these accounts, they're essentially FanDuel and DraftKings are essentially banks. I mean, they're holding significant portions of people's money, and theoretically, they could refuse to let them take it out. Right? I remember that being when I was doing my article that was a kind of an inside baseball issue, but it's kind of an important one. Do you have any understanding of that, or are you concerned about that, or have you heard anything about that aspect of how the business works?
All I know about that is that the funds that they take in are supposed to be separated into prizes and operating expenses, and they need to keep everything separate. And I think that may be part of the legislation that's coming down in some of the states because there was some allegation of intermingling of funds. But as long as they keep that separate, they're following the law as far as I know.
Yeah, keeping it separate. If they don't keep it separate, it's probably going far calling it a Ponzi scheme, but it kind of operates like that. If they don't keep it separate,
yeah.
It's like it's essentially sort of not quite on the Bernie Madoff level, but it isn't
exactly.
That to me that can be troublesome.
Yeah. Exactly. That's why it's a key issue.
And going forward, I still get over some of the trouble spots when I was writing my article was, A, multi-entry tournaments. How many entries can you have? At Fantasy Draft, you can play, I think, the most is like 5 or 6. And I like that. I like that you can do multiple lineups without having hundreds. I think that's a fair balance. Age limits, I don't think that makes a big deal. I can understand ethically why some people want certain age limits. That's fine. I understand having it. But I don't think that's a big deal when it comes to the industry on the whole. But then more transparency, scripting, and things like that. I don't know how this industry goes forward, DFS-wise, successfully, if you don't allow hundreds of entries upon which these companies take out a percentage. And if players realize that if you don't enter hundreds of times, you can't win, once they realize that they're dead money and don't play, these things, I don't know how the industry operates without putting in these kinds of restrictions that the states are going to want. And if they do implement them, I don't know how the industry survives. I'm curious, going forward, there's a lot of murky right now. We don't know any of these things in a lot of places. But I'm not sure how they resolve those issues. I'm curious what if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, I mean, the companies now have said that players are limited to 150 lineups per contest, which is down from basically an unlimited number of lineups per contest. So they've brought that down, and that kind of protects them a little bit to be able to generate the revenue influx they need in order to support the game. It's not good enough. I mean, it's simply not good enough as far as providing a level playing field for all the competitors, like you said. So there are going to be people who are not going to play because they can't afford. They simply can't afford to spend the time or the money to put in that many lineups. So as long as there's education and as long as they know that they're dead money if they don't do it, hopefully they won't play. And basically, they're trying to separate the experienced players from the novice players. And they are putting in some sort of protections for that, although I don't know how they really can enforce that. That doesn't seem like something that would be easily enforced. But if the veteran players are the ones who are putting in the hundreds of entries and the novices are the ones who recognize that, you know, they're not going to win unless they, you know, they play at their level, maybe they can make a go of this. But, you know, like we're saying all along, this is so murky right now, and there's so many variables, there's so many gray areas that it's really hard to see how this is going to evolve.
And if you have to guess, and again, maybe you know numbers or maybe you're just guessing, how many people who like sports, not necessarily like fantasy sports, but how many people who enjoy sports actually are willing to deposit some money into one of these sites and actually participate in daily fantasy sports?
Well, lots. And it's not just people who like sports. I mean, when the government shut down the online poker sites, they've been looking, those folks who play the online poker are looking for another outlet. And fantasy has just been huge for them. And now daily fantasy, there are a lot of gamblers who play daily fantasy who have no interest in sports whatsoever. They buy these subscriptions to, you know, some of the informational sites, and they do their lineups, and they recognize the odds when they enter hundreds of lineups, and they're not even sports fans at all. The population of people who play DFS is huge, and it's not at all just sports fans, not at all.
So it can keep growing, because when these companies, before the, as the ESPN article says, imploded, before the industry imploded, their evaluations of these companies were in the billions. Then once the legal elements started to happen and the Attorney General Snyderman from New York smacked them with different legal proceedings, they dropped their evaluations by about 60%, I think was one of the numbers out there.
Right.
I'm curious what those evaluations are now, especially with a 15% tax on gross incomes. I'm curious what these companies are worth when they're making those kinds of percentages, which seem to be kind of small.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that, but it's the industry is changing, and the whole environment is changing. So these companies who had grandiose thoughts of becoming these multi-billion-dollar corporations and then IPOs and all that sort of stuff, they're bringing down their expectations because it's all changing now.
And what do you see as the future? Where do you think this industry is going?
Well, I think it's going to be a constant push-pull for FanDuel and DraftKings in particular to maintain their survival, to somehow find some profitability, because neither one of them is profitable yet. There's going to be a push from the players who are used to the large prizes, will eventually get used to smaller prizes for their investments in each of these contests. We'll probably reach a middle ground at some point. Hopefully the people who recognize that certain types of games have a very low probability of winning, they'll stop playing them. It'll change the structure of of these games within the game site somewhat. It'll probably force the game companies to come up with new innovations for different types of games to entice people to play, like this full season version, which ends up competing a little bit with the big guys like ESPN and Yahoo, which, you know, all things considered, you know, given everything that they've done up until this point, was probably a very good move for to help their companies weather what's been going on with all the other games. There are going to be a lot of changes. I think within the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see lots of changes, and I think the game that we see now is going to look very different by 2018, 2019. I think it'll be a very different game.
And I'm curious, because when you play yearlies and you play them on different sites, I think it's CBS allows you to actually, and I think maybe all the sites do it now, but I think it's CBS, I remember, has been doing it for quite some time, where they would keep track of money for the leagues. And that's been going on for years before DFS ever started, as far as I know. Or maybe I started playing yearly leagues and DFS existed and I wasn't aware of it. But I think I've been playing fantasy long enough where that wasn't the case. Could this all eventually come around to impact yearly leagues, or will they just take the money aspect of it off the books? You know, CBS will stop listing who paid their money and who didn't, and people will just do that on the side, sort of like these March Madness tournaments where everyone does this behind the scenes rather than having it literally online. Do you think it could impact yearly leagues at all, the fact that this money in some states could be legal?
Isn't the CBS thing more of just an accounting function?
Doesn't it imply that they're playing for money, though? I mean, it's only an accounting function, but doesn't that say that they're gambling?
Well, gambling in terms of what, playing in a full season league? I mean, that gets into the whole argument about, you know, how full season is different than DFS with the whole gambling aspect, which, I think we're talking apples and oranges. But, in the pure terms of gambling, sure, it's all gambling. Yeah, all of this is gambling, but in terms of let me talk about it for a minute. I mean, there's a whole argument about whether if DFS is gambling, why isn't full season gambling? And for me, there's a huge difference there, because in DFS, once you do the research and set your roster and the results are completely out of your hands. You may have done the best prep work. You may have determined that the odds were in your favor to stack Rockies hitters or have Paul Goldschmidt face Tim Lincecum or play Max Scherzer against the Padres at Petco. Once you lock your roster, you become a spectator. Everything that happens from that point on is left to fate. But in full season, you have the opportunity to react to changing conditions and take an active role in the results of your team. And that process of taking an active role is a huge differentiator. A player gets hurt, you replace him, you have a weakness in a category, you make a trade, you get to track player performance over time and analyze what is real and what is small sample size fluke. It's an interactive process that gives you far more control over the eventual outcome of your team. And I think that's a huge difference, making full season less of a gambling game than DFS. And I think – I don't know if enough has been written about that, because I know that, you know, FanDuel and DraftKings have actually, you know, Nigel Eklund has actually come out at some point and said that DFS takes more skill than full season fantasy, which is just absurd to me. But again, you know, everything they do and say is meant to try to preserve their companies and survival and whatnot. But I mean, from a strictly logical sense, there's no difference between the two types of games. And, you know, on the gambling scale, I would say that full season is maybe 70% skill and 30% chance, and DFS is the exact opposite.
Yeah, one of the key things that I always talk about when we talk about fantasy on this podcast is that the waiver wire is crucial. And so there's a lot of activity that goes on. There's trades and things like that, and people skills and communication, which actually impact how leagues stand
sure.
and things like that. Sure. I agree with you. I agree with that. I guess the impetus of the question was, anytime you attach dollars to fantasy, I think people maybe make the connection. And so with DFS having all these legal issues, could that kind of bleed into yearly? And I agree with your sentiment. I'm just wondering if everybody makes that same kind of distinction.
Yeah, they don't. And the people who don't, who are the most dangerous, are many of the attorneys general in a lot of the states who are not familiar with fantasy at all. So this whole DFS controversy has been, for many of them, their first exposure to what fantasy sports is at all. So they liken what's happened with DFS to what has been going on in fantasy sports for 30 years now. And that's not fair, but they need to be educated. And that's a lot of what the FSPA has been trying to do, going into each of the states and lobbying to show that, you know, fantasy sports is a legal operation, has been, is protected by the UIGEA, and on and on. And they're trying to make the case that DFS is just one type of game under the umbrella of fantasy. But, you know, there are enough distinctions to separate the two of them. And, you know, part of one of the arguments I made is that you can't fight the battle for both because they're just too different.
And just to wrap it up, we're talking with Ron Chandler, and I am Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later. Let me ask you just real quickly about the ESPN article. I thought it was very interesting. What were some of your thoughts or some of the impressions you got from reading that article, about a week ago?
Well, you know, they talked about an implosion. I thought that may have been a little bit of hyperbole. It was clearly a very pointed article. There were a few facts there that I thought they left out, one of which was that they never mentioned that in some states, like in Virginia, there was the exorbitant upfront fees that effectively blocked, you know, game companies out except FanDuel and DraftKings. But, you know, it brought up the questions. They talked about banning third-party scripting, which, you know, is nice, but banning all scripting would be better. You know, and they talked about limiting entries to 150, which is nice, but limiting it to 10 or 5 is better. And, you know, the whole aspect of separating contests by skill is nice. But, you know, again, what's preventing a shark from opening a new account under a fake name? I don't know how they regulate that, how they control that. And, you know, I just had to laugh at a lot of the quotes from Jason Robbins and Nigel Eccles, which were clearly just sound bites to try to protect their companies, but made no logical sense at all, and got me a little angry too. So, I mean, it was an interesting article. It was a good rundown of what's been going on over the last year or so, actually the last few years. And I think it informed a lot of people who might not have been aware of how this thing has evolved.
And when I was doing the research for my article for Baseball America, obviously I talked with you. You're very outspoken and honest about the strengths and weaknesses, the ethical and unethical aspects of it. You're much more upfront and honest about it than a lot of other people in the industry. I talked with other people in the industry. I talked with a lot of people within the DFS industry. A lot of times they don't want their name out there. They're willing to talk to me, but they say, don't put my name in there. Don't quote me. Don't refer to me. Don't tell people that you got my thoughts on it. So they're afraid of some kind of backlash. But sure. Also, I think you do see a lot of people that maybe they're tainted, maybe they're biased unintentionally, but it does seem like a lot of people who work in the daily fantasy industry, and I work on the kind of the fringes. I write for RotoExperts.com, so I do baseball for one site, but I write about fantasy for Baseball America and for RotoExperts.com, and I had a TV show on the Fantasy Sports Television Network. I was the first program that ever aired on that network. So I'm in the industry, but nobody would call me a giant in it by any means. No one would even put me even remotely close. You know, we're states apart, you and me. So you have a significantly higher profile in status in the industry than I ever had. But the people that I talk with, they really seem to be very, very much advocates rather than kind of the tact you take, which is to be honest about it, about the entire industry and where it should be. Do you come across that? Because when you talk with DFS people, it just doesn't seem like they seem to see all the rosy, and they don't seem to see some of the questions or maybe some of the negatives. Is that your impression?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, sure. There is so much money changing hands now. People don't want to see that go away. You know, as much as FanDuel and DraftKings have done some harm to the industry and the perception of the industry as a whole, I mean, there are millions and millions of dollars that's changing hands every day. People don't want to see that go away. A lot of people are making a lot of money right now. They want to try to save that. They want to figure out a way to preserve as much of it as you can. You know, me personally, to be honest, I don't give a crap about the money that they're making. I'm not making any money off of that. So I been in this industry now for over three decades. I've seen the cycles. I've seen the dot-com implosion in 2000. I've seen the rise of high-stakes games. I've seen this all for 30 years, and there's been nothing that has had such an impact in this industry as DFS over the last few years. And the amount of money that is exchanging hands is extraordinary. Nobody wants to see that go away, so they're going to do everything they can to save it. And I understand that, and I recognize it. So people are going to be very careful in what they say. They're going to parse their words. They're going to try to have the right sound bites in the media. They don't want this going away. It's too big.
And when I wrote my article, and the article that appears in Baseball America is an edited version of my original piece, and the editors over at Baseball America thought that my article was too biased. When I sent it over to the guys over at FSTA who I interviewed, they actually had some disagreement with it as well. I'm assuming, because I didn't get into the details of the disagreements on it with them, but I'm assuming that the FSTA people disagreed with me on different aspects than the Baseball America editors did. So I think I had people disagreeing with me on both sides. But my point is, Baseball America thought I was being biased when I wrote my original article, and part of that was probably because a lot of my sources, a lot of my background information was from people within the fantasy industry. And overwhelmingly, they all thought that there was so much money in it now that it had to keep going. The DFS was going to be legislated, there were going to be changes, but that there was so much money, it was going to definitely go forward. A, do you believe that's true? And B, when we talk about some of these economic challenges to the business model, so much money, maybe there won't be quite as much money going forward. I'm just curious what your thoughts are with that.
Well, I mean, when we're talking about billions of dollars, even if it has to be scaled down to hundreds of millions, that's still quite a bit of money. So
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if we're going to say that they're too big to fail. But when you've got major media companies involved, like ESPN and Yahoo, when you've got the major sports leagues involved, you know, the MLB, NFL, NBA, I mean, it's too big. It's too big. And people have too much of a vested interest in seeing it succeed in some form. I believe it will succeed in some form, but it will likely look different than the way we see it now.
And do you think it'll look different, or do you think it'll be completely and totally different where we don't even recognize what DFS is in 2022 as opposed to what we're seeing in 2016?
I don't know that it's going to be radically different. I think, you know, technology and what will give us the opportunity to do different things. I mean, I could see us going to arenas and stadiums and having a DFS tournament at our seats so we can be playing the game while we're watching the Knicks and the Bucks play on the court. You know, it's you know, from that aspect, it's going to be different. And I think it's going to be better. It's going to give fans a chance to be more involved in the game and more engaged, which is always a good thing. Again, putting down $5 to win $1 million, I think those days are going to be long gone.
What's the impact on yearly? Does DFS have an impact on daily, and is it significant?
On yearly, I think they'll continue to evolve separately for the most part. I think the fact that the FanDuel and DraftKings are offering a style of seasonal game will have some impact down the line. I think people. Especially in baseball, I mean, my background has been in baseball now for 30 years. I think there are still lots of people, especially these days, who once August rolls around, they start to lose interest. DFS gives them a chance to play a seasonal type game where each day or each week it's still its own contest, so there's still an incentive to play. From that aspect, I think it's a good thing. You want to find ways to keep users engaged and to keep interest up, and if DFS serves that purpose, then all the power to them. That would be a very good thing. I mean, we've been fighting team abandonment for decades now in full season games, so where teams that fall out of competition late in the season just abandon their teams, and that's never a good thing for a league. So if there's a way to keep people engaged, I think that's a great thing.
And that's what I love about Dynasty. I'm more of a Dynasty guy. I like yearly leagues. I like the fun of drafting. But Dynasty leagues, there's always interest somehow, and that, so we don't have that problem. The expansive keeper leagues and dynasty, that's where I like to do best. But also, I'm a prospects guy, so minor league prospects play a pretty big role in those, and so that's an aspect of the game that maybe not everyone's involved in either. That's a little bit of a niche sport there. But aspect of fantasy anyway. But what did I not ask you? What thoughts do you have? What opinions do I have that I wasn't insightful enough to ask you today?
No, I think you covered pretty much everything. I think it's an interesting time in this industry now, I'll tell you. The thing that angers me the most is just the things that are often being said and how things are being perceived. I'm not real happy that DFS has, to some extent, has thrown full season under the bus in order for them to survive. And, you know, that's a battle that we're going to keep having to fight. But in the end, you know, fantasy sports is ingrained in our culture right now for sports fans. And for one way or another, it will survive. What it's going to look like, I don't know, but it's here to stay. So it's just a matter of dealing with these legal issues now and hoping moving forward that we'll have a stronger and more vibrant industry to play these games with. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
And you've seen a lot of changes in the fantasy world since you got started to now. Is this the biggest change? Is this the biggest kind of upheaval that the industry has been thrown in since you've been following it, as you said, for three decades?
Oh, yeah, 3 days. Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. You know, there was a big upheaval with the baseball strike in 1994 and 95. You know, a lot of companies went out of business, and survival was a little bit tough. And when the dot-com bust in 1999 and 2000, again, it was tough getting through that. You know, in the early 2000s, high stakes leagues kind of changed the complexion of the industry, but nothing has made such major changes to the industry as DFS has over the last few years. So yeah, major upheaval, and it's been a fun ride.
The one thing I do like about DFS, because I like to talk on radio, and as you can tell, I've kept you here for a little over an hour, so I go on and on and on here. But one thing I like about the All-Star Game or any of these things, DFS does create conversation every single day. You can talk about the lineups, you can talk about the matchups, you can say, you know, it allows you to have an interesting discussion every single day. I don't love playing DFS. I enjoy it. Like you said, I enjoy it to some degree. But I do like the conversation. It's very easy for radio where you just say, what do you think about these splits? And what do you think about the fact that they're at this? And I do think at the very least for radio purposes and for the Fantasy Sports Television Network and TV, it does play well for that. It makes it easy to have conversations on a daily basis because everything is constantly changing. The matchups are always changing. From that perspective, I like DFS, and I think it from a media perspective, it does a very good job in generating money for that. Regardless of the illegality and whether the DFS sites can survive or not, I think it does make for a very good conversation for the sake of fantasy radio and television.
Yeah, I actually had a conversation with a colleague, Todd Zola, who you may be familiar from Masters Ball in ESPN, maybe about a week or two ago. And I asked him, I said, you know, we started playing this game in the 1980s it was a social game. It was based on the camaraderie. And I say, I don't see that in DFS. Where is the camaraderie that we have in having a live draft and having trade proposals and whatnot? That doesn't seem to be there. It seems to be a missing element. And he said to me, no, not at all. And just like you said, the camaraderie is different in DFS. People are talking about possible lineups. They're not talking about competing against each other necessarily in a different contest on a given day, but they're talking about players, they're talking about analysis, and it's generating a different type of conversation and camaraderie. So from that aspect, if we can keep the social aspect of the game that way, that's a good thing too.
And I actually think that's very well intertwined with social media. I think social media, I'm getting off into the psychology of the world here, but social media, it seems like people want to express their opinions more these days. They want someone to listen to their opinions, and they want to be able to express them. I don't know Kurt Schilling is on my Facebook feed. He can't stop talking about everything. It drives me nuts. But and I think social media feeds that. It allows people to express their opinions. Even though I don't want any more of Kurt Schilling's opinion, I don't care about his opinion on whether a dog has three legs or not. I don't care. But he seems to have a strong opinion on everything, and that drives me nuts. But that's what social media is. And so with social media, promoting conversation and promoting the ability for people to express an opinion, even though no one's listening. If I post someone on something on Twitter, I have just over 1,000 followers. So essentially, probably 800 of those are fake, and the other 300 don't see my post because they get lost in the noise of Twitter. So they just I post something, they don't even see it. And yet it makes me feel good to be able to express myself on Twitter, just say so-and-so was stupid or whatever. And it seems like DFS plays into that perfectly. I can say I like this matchup today and go on and on. It allows me to express myself, and it allows me to think at least that someone's listening to me. It seems like social media plays into that.
Oh, sure. And, I mean, you're exactly right. I there's nothing I could add to what you said. I mean, it's a perfect marriage between the camaraderie of sharing information on DFS and the social media gives you the distribution channel to do that. It's a perfect marriage.
Ron Chandler, author of The Baseball Forecaster. This is his 31st annual edition coming out this winter. You can find him at ronchandler.com, ESPN.com. And, of course, you can follow him on Twitter at Ron Chandler. Ron, promote anything you like, anything you want to let people know about you or where they can go other than what I just said there, or are we all settled there?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I also have a Facebook page at ronchandler.baseball on Facebook. Where I post a lot of tidbits and articles and whatnot. But beyond that, you know, Twitter, ronchandler.com, my Wednesday article each week at ESPN. It's all good stuff.
What's today's article?
Oh, today's article. It's been a really difficult pitching year for me this year. For the first time in I don't know how long, I find myself in some of my leagues at the bottom of the ERA and WHIP categories. And so I took a look back at about 10 of the pitchers who I drafted and picked up via free agent who failed and tried to figure out what was the rationalization for me to pick them up and why did they fail and what kind of lessons have I learned. So, an interesting piece on this, 10 different pitchers who have dragged me down this year.
I don't want to keep you any longer if you need to go, because I've kept you much longer than you dedicating all the time. I really appreciate it. Can I ask you a couple fantasy questions, or do you want me to let you go? Because I completely understand. I've hogged your time already.
Yeah, I hate to be a bummer on this, but it's I do have a commitment in about 10 minutes, so I'm probably going to just bolt at this point, if that's okay.
Oh, I completely understand. I held you longer than I should have, so thank you very much for putting in the time today. Again, Ron Chandler, head on over to ESPN.com and get his articles. But thanks a lot for coming on and talking DFS with us today. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. It's my pleasure being on. If you want to drop me an email with your questions, I'll certainly respond to it that way.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All right, Ron, be good. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
All right, again, that's Ron Chandler, author of The Baseball Forecaster. He's coming out with his 31st annual edition this winter. Highly recommend you go out there and check it out. The easiest way to find him and to be pushed over or sent to wherever you need to in order to be able to access his content, as well as where you can purchase The Baseball Forecaster, you can follow him on Twitter at Ron Chandler. You can also go over to ronchandler.com. And like he said, he's got his Wednesday articles over at ESPN.com. A legend in the industry. He's very knowledgeable, obviously been doing this for quite some time. I highly recommend everybody out there, if you're not tuning in to Ron Chandler in a variety of different ways, then you're doing something wrong here. I can attest to that for sure. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. This has been a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. You can tune into this podcast over at minorleagueball.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I can direct you to all of our different podcasts, because I've been doing a lot of them, almost all baseball-related, but we do some fantasy podcasts. I've even been doing some football podcasts. So if you're a football guy or girl, you can find some of those as well. One of the easier ways for you to do that is you can follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73, and I can just direct you or send you links to whatever you may need to know. You can read my fantasy content over at rotoexperts.com. And like I said, if you want to read my baseball content or follow the podcast or access the links to the podcast, you can head on over to minorleagueball.com. Or like Ron had mentioned, you can get him on Facebook. You can also join our baseball groups over on Facebook. The one fantasy one is the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show. If you want to do the baseball one, which is associated with this podcast, it's a podcast to be named later. If you want to post articles on there, if you want to suggest topics for discussion, we're more than happy to talk baseball of any kind. Baseball, fantasy baseball, minor leagues, you name it. I'm more than happy to talk about it with you. And oftentimes I bring it to the program. So if you've got some topics you think could be interesting for the podcast, I'd be more than happy to look at it and bring it to the program. We do about 3 or 4 podcasts a week here. So we do a fair share of stuff on here when it comes to content. But hopefully you enjoyed the program. I love having Ron on. That's the second time we've had him on in a few months. I really appreciate him bringing his information to the show. These guys don't have to come on these programs. I'm not paying them to come on here. They dedicate their time purely out of generosity and charity. So I appreciate it very much when they take the time to come on here. And DFS is definitely an interesting topic in my opinion. So very interesting talking with Ron today. So thanks a lot to him. Hopefully you all enjoyed it. And hopefully you'll continue to tune in. Thanks, everybody.
Hello, I'm Bobby McMahon from RotoExperts.com here with...
I think it's safe to say that our luck has officially turned around, guys. We are back, baby.